It's Friday, January 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, an expert on pandemic control says China's strategy to control the coronavirus outbreak is not likely to work.
All the evidence from past attempts at quarantine suggests that this is unlikely to be effective.
And I'm Jackson Vunganyi. An exclusive interview with a UN researcher on the alleged hacking of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos' phone by Saudi Arabia. It's all on today's International Edition.
Democratic House impeachment managers continue to make their case that at President Donald Trump's impeachment trial, saying that he had abused power like no other president in history, swept up by a Ukraine theory pushed by attorney Rudy Giuliani. Today, Democrats have their final day of arguments, focusing on the second article of impeachment, obstruction of Congress's investigation. Jackson Mungani speaks in studio with VOA's Jim Malone.
So, Jim, thank you for joining us today. In hours of arguments, Democrats led by impeachment manager Representative Adam Schiff made their case on the second day of impeachment trial. How effective were they?
Well, if you talk to Democrats, they'll say that Schiff has made a very impressive case, as has his co-managers, about what they see as the extent of President Trump's activities to try to enlist Ukraine to help him in his reelection effort. Now, if you talk to Republicans, and this is a key factor because what you have to ask is, are they converting anyone? So far, it doesn't seem as though they are, that the Republicans basically are sticking with the idea that they're basically giving the president the benefit of the doubt. They're also complaining that the arguments are repetitive and go on for hours, which that is the nature of an impeachment trial.
Now, this morning, President Trump complained in a tweet that his defense will begin on a Saturday, which he called, quote, Death Valley TV. Is this to imply that not many people will be watching?
Yeah, we have to remember that President Trump isn't just president. He's an expert on TV and a former TV producer from his show. So he has a very keen understanding of how politics interacts with the public, especially through the medium of television. So he's worried that there's going to be a drop-off in the audience. But look, the way this works is Democrats had 3 days to present their opening arguments, and Republicans will also get the same time. After that, there'll be a period of a couple of days or so for questioning. And then, of course, the key issue will be, will Democrats be able to convince just a few Republicans to support their call for additional witnesses, people like former National Security Advisor John Bolton?
So, prosecution wraps up today. Senators have had to sit through long hours of presentations. Let's talk about format and rules. You know, Senate impeachment trial rules stipulate that there's no talking, that there's no phone, there's no, you know, you can't even get coffee. But we have seen that some senators have struggled with even staying attentive. How much of this has been an issue?
I guess you have to be a little sympathetic. They're supposed to sit there for hours on end. Some of them like to get up, move around. I saw Cory Booker talking about this, the need to keep moving. They grab candy and other snacks from a desk. So it is a struggle, especially senators are not used to being quiet and just sitting there. And that's going to have to be the way it goes until the end of the trial.
So as the president's defense gets ready to take the floor tomorrow, what should we be expecting tomorrow, this weekend, and next week?
We're going to hear the president and his lawyers trying to tear apart the case, basically say nothing happened, and that certainly if anything did go awry, it's not worth the elevating it to a level of impeachment and actually removing the president from office. So they're going to have their time to make their case. The president needs to stay.
That was VOA's Jim Malone joining us here in studio. Thank you, Jim.
Sure.
China ramped up measures to contain a new virus that has killed 26 people and infected more than 800. China has locked down almost a dozen cities, affecting some 36 million people. China announced Friday that it is building a 1,000-bed hospital dedicated to patients infected with the new virus. Beijing has also shut down temples and closed the Forbidden City and also closed part of the Great Wall. The two-week Lunar New Year holiday began Friday, raising fears that the infection rate could accelerate as hundreds of millions of people travel to their homes and abroad in what is usually a festive time of year. In Wuhan, where the illness has been concentrated, normally bustling streets, malls, and other public spaces were eerily quiet Friday. Masks were mandatory in public, and images from the city showed empty store shelves as people stocked up for what could be an extended isolation. Hospitals in Wuhan were grappling with a flood of patients and a lack of supplies. Videos circulating online showed throngs of frantic people in masks lined up for checks. The World Health Organization has declared the new coronavirus an emergency for China, but stopped short of declaring the epidemic of international concern. While most of the cases and all of the deaths have been in China, the virus has also been detected in Thailand, Vietnam, Singapore, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and the United States. It was likely Britain also had cases, a health official said. There's no vaccine available yet, but Gilead Sciences, which developed an experimental Ebola treatment, said it is assessing whether that treatment could be used on the new coronavirus. Three other research teams were starting work on vaccines as well, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations said. For more on what it will take to halt the outbreak, I spoke earlier with Dr. Eric Toner, an expert on pandemic preparedness at Johns Hopkins University near Washington, D.C.
We are seeing a rapid rise in the number of confirmed cases, but we don't know whether this is due to rapid spread of the disease or whether this is a result of a backlog in reporting test results from previous patients. But certainly the numbers are beginning to become quite concerning. One can easily imagine that this will get to the level of the number of SARS patients, you know, fairly quickly. It already approaching the number of patients that have been infected with the MERS virus.
So far, China's main approach to halting the outbreak seems to be locking down cities. This seems to be a pretty unprecedented or unusual strategy. Is it an effective means to stopping an outbreak?
Well, it is unprecedented. No country has ever tried to do geographic quarantine on this scale. But all the evidence from past attempts at quarantine suggests that this is unlikely to be effective. The typical response of the population to quarantine is to try to escape. This was seen in previous outbreaks and previous attempts at quarantine, including in West Africa during Ebola and in China during SARS. It is very difficult to try and block every mode of transportation around a city of 11 million people. People will find a way to get around the barriers.
So what is a perhaps better approach to limit the spread of the disease?
The first question is, can you limit the spread of the disease? If this disease is like SARS, in that it doesn't transmit readily within the community, then it's containable by good infection control practices within hospitals. Now, that's largely why SARS was contained, because the disease was not contagious for the most part, out in, you know, amongst families or in the workplace or out in the community. It was only very contagious within when people were desperately sick in hospitals. If it turns out that this virus is being readily transmitted in the community setting, then it probably is not containable.
There's been some talk about vaccines in development, including the experimental Ebola vaccine. How quickly could a vaccine be developed for this, and could that even help bring it under control?
There will likely be many candidate vaccines, that is, scientists who come up with a vaccine that they think is promising in the laboratory. But then these have to get into animal studies, and then they have to go into human studies. And this process takes months, even at the most accelerated rate, before we know whether the vaccine actually works and whether it is actually safe. And then it has to be manufactured on a global scale and then distributed and administered to those people. So we don't yet have a vaccine for SARS, and we don't have a vaccine for MERS. Both of these diseases have been around for many, many years. We don't have a vaccine for most of the emerging infectious disease of the last couple decades. So I would be very, very pleased but very surprised if we had a vaccine that makes any difference in the growth of this epidemic.
Thanks very much, Dr. Toner. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Tens of thousands of Iraqis rallied in central Baghdad Friday after prominent Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr called for a, quote, million-strong, end quote, protest against U.S. military presence in the country. The march follows the U.S. killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and an Iraqi military chief, as well as rocket attacks from Iran-linked militias on U.S. bases. But Iraqi anti-government protesters, who have been in the streets for months, fear the new protest could undermine their cause. Earlier today, I spoke with VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch in central Baghdad.
Fairly early this morning, around 8:30 or 9, by then there were thousands, and then mid-morning tens of thousands of people that joined the protest calling for the U.S. military to leave Iraq. People were carrying signs saying, I'm Iraqi against the presence of America. Some people were carrying more dramatic signs saying, death to America and death to Israel. So far today has been peaceful, but right now I can hear increasing amounts of gunfire at a different protest, so I'm not sure the day will end peaceful.
Who is protesting? Because there have been a lot of anti-government protests, anti-Iraqi government protests going on for months now. Are these the same people as that protest, who have been asking for reforms and better government services and better job opportunities and an end to corruption? Are these those same protesters, or are these different protesters?
This protest was completely separate to the anti-government protests, and a lot of the people who have been protesting against the Iraqi government were not involved in the protest today calling for the U.S. military to leave. That protest was called for by a prominent Shiite religious cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr, who called for the U.S. military to leave. It was very much a sectarian or, you know, specific groups that were attending this protest, as opposed to the anti-government protests that tend more to attract protesters across all sects and religions in Iraq.
Where does al-Sadr fit in politically within the tensions between the U.S. and Iran, and also within the Iraqi political sphere?
He's a very powerful man here in Iraq and very popular among his followers, although not popular with everyone. He, in the past, has been fiercely anti-American, although more recently he's been much known as much more of a nationalist that is neither associated with America or Iran, although loosely associated with Iran, as he is a leader there's more gunfire. I just wanted to take a look to see if it was okay. He's been a leader of Shia militias, and these are backed by Iran sometimes. More recently, since all of this happened between the U.S. and Iran in Iraq, he has taken a strong stance pro-Iran and anti-America, which is similar to his stance in the past.
Is this protest really galvanizing his movement and showing his power and his force, or, you know, what might we expect to see after this?
Well, I'm not sure what will happen on the international level, because the U.S. has not said they have any intention of leaving, and the Iraqi ministers, I don't know if they have any interest or ability to make the U.S. leave. U.S. exit from Iraq, while people think of it in the long term, that should happen. Most Iraqis think that. But in the short term, the Sunnis and the Kurds have come out to say, the Sunnis have more gently, but both have expressed their disapproval of this idea. Locally, though, however, this might have a much quicker and more predictable outcome, in that it is making the protests in Iraq, if you can imagine, even more prone to sectarian tensions. And you can already hear from protesters, anti-government protesters, tensions and fears that the Sadr protesters following Sadr will actually try to take over and lead the way. And they don't want leaders, and they don't want a sectarian protest movement. They want a movement that includes everyone.
Now, we can hear in the background as you're talking what sounds to me like gunfire. What's happening there, and are you safe?
Well, we can see kids running in and out of the protests on the bridge. I'm a little bit below the bridge. A lot of them are carrying metal shields that it looks like they made out of barrels and painted them black with white slogans on them. So it's possible that there is a fight going on directly at the moment. I'm taking shelter, and I'm standing with a couple of police officers behind a wall at the moment. So I think we're okay, but I don't think this neighborhood is going to be okay to stay in for too long after dark.
That was VOA's Heather Murdoch in Baghdad. U.S. President Donald Trump says it's time to release his long-awaited Middle East peace plan and has invited Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and opposition leader Benny Gantz to the White House next week to discuss it. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
President Trump says he will most likely release his long-awaited peace plan even before Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and possibly Netanyahu's election rival Benny Gantz arrive in Washington next Tuesday. Trump said it is a great plan and one that will really work. Israeli news reports say it will include a unilateral annexation of the Jordan Valley, about a fifth of the West Bank that runs along the border between the West Bank and Jordan. Israel has long said that the area is important for Israel's security. About 13,000 Jewish settlers as well as 4,000 Palestinians live there. The reports said the plan would also give Israel sovereignty over all Jewish settlements in the West Bank, where more than 400,000 Israelis live. If that happens, it would be a major change in U.S. policy and anger the Palestinians. Prime Minister Netanyahu said he accepted President Trump's invitation with pleasure.
We have had no better friend than President Trump. That friendship is expressed in the fact that we're in the American Embassy in Jerusalem, that Jerusalem was recognized by President Trump as Israel's capital, that President Trump has recognized Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. And now, with this invitation, I think that the president is seeking to give Israel peace and security, the peace and security that it deserves.
Palestinians see the reported plan as dangerous. Nabil Abu Rudaina, spokesman for Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas, warned the U.S. from crossing any more red lines. He said the Palestinians will not accept any plan that does not give them sovereignty over the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem. Abbas met Thursday with Russian President Vladimir Putin, who was in Israel for the commemoration of the World Holocaust Forum, and asked for Putin's support in the future. Abbas said there are some regional issues that need to be discussed with President Putin, such as Israel's announcement to annex Palestinian land. Abbas also said there is the need to talk about this deal of the century, which Mr. Trump said will be published soon. Abbas also said we need to talk about this issue. Also, we have the issue of the Palestinian presidential and parliament elections that we will inform the president about. Abbas said the Palestinians want to discuss Israel's announcement to annex Palestinian land as well as other regional issues. Jordan's foreign minister, Ayman Safadi, also warned that if Israel annexes the Jordan Valley, it would end the chances for peace between Israelis and Palestinians. The Washington visit comes as Netanyahu and Gantz are due to face off in Israel's third election within a year. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
The United Nations experts have called for an immediate investigation by the United States and others into information they received that suggests that Amazon owner billionaire Jeff Bezos' phone was hacked after receiving a file sent from Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's WhatsApp account. David Kaye is one of the UN special rapporteurs. He says that the UN is concerned about wider efforts by the Saudi government to silence and infiltrate communication devices of well-known Saudi dissidents and manipulate social media to amplify voices praising Prince Mohammed and drown out his critics.
What we reviewed was a forensic report that provided significant information about the alleged hack of a phone belonging to Jeff Bezos. Through his WhatsApp account and through an account that belonged to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. And the information provides details, I mean, factual information about how the two exchanged information originally, their contact numbers, and the kinds of messages that were sent from the Crown Prince, at least from his account, to Mr. Bezos.
Now, some people will ask how this issue falls within the purview of the UN. Can you explain to us how the UN is involved and why?
Yeah, so in my own mandate, which is a mandate that was created by the United Nations Human Rights Council, the central human rights body of the UN system, I was mandated. I mean, I am formally asked to gather and consider information related to alleged violations of freedom of expression. And, you know, for several years, I have been, you know, gathering information and reporting on instances of surveillance, both mass surveillance and the kind of targeted surveillance that's at issue here, because of the way in which surveillance has the potential to interfere with the freedom of expression. Surveillance is often used as a tool to intimidate journalists or activists not to speak. It's often used as a way to blackmail people to avoid government criticism. And it has a very, very serious chilling effect on all sorts of speakers. So, you know, this falls, you know, directly into our mandates. It falls directly into the kind of standard operating procedure that we pursue when we are dealing with cases of human rights violations. And you can go and look at all of the different communications we've done over the years to see that this is you know, actually quite consistent with our normal practices.
Right. And were you able to draw a connection between what happened in this case and the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi?
Well, that's one of the questions that's a part of our ongoing investigation. You know, one of the things that we see, and this is a part of the annex to our public statement yesterday, is that at the same time that we have these allegations of hacking against Mr. Bezos, we also have very strong evidence of the hacking of individual Saudi activists and journalists who are associates of Jamal Khashoggi, and the evidence of the hacking, is directly in the same time frame as the period in which there was increasing intimidation of Jamal Khashoggi and preceded the, the ultimate murder of Jamal Khashoggi. So, you know, the connections between that, the fact that the pattern of the allegations is strikingly similar between the activists and the hack of, or the alleged hacking of Mr. Bezos is certainly enough for us to, if not draw conclusions, to draw from them very, very serious concerns that need to be addressed by the government and ideally by independent fact finders.
That was David Kaye, Special Rapporteur, UN Special Rapporteur, speaking to me from California. The U.S. State Department is giving visa officers more power to block pregnant women from visiting the United States. The new rule, which takes effect today, directs consular officers abroad to reject women they believe that are entering the United States with the sole intention of giving birth and giving their children U.S. citizenship. VOA's national correspondent Victoria Mackey joins us in studio for more on this. So, Victoria, can you explain to our listeners what is birth tourism?
So birth tourism is this idea that there are women who often pay to come to the U.S. in order to give birth. And because we have in the United States birthright citizenship, this concept that if you were born here, you do immediately receive U.S. citizenship. The idea is that women come here, give birth, and immediately their children are U.S. citizens. So they're sort of, you know, taking advantage of a system in order for their children to become American citizens from the first breath they take here.
All right. Thank you very much, Victoria Mackey. That's VOA's national correspondent, Victoria Mackey. You have been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our producer, Dan Brown, our engineer, Nick Ivanov. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, together with my co-host, Jason Patinkin. Have a good day, everyone.